Okay, so we'll start. Do you have any, can you hear in the back all right? No? Can't hear. How's that? Better? No? Still bad? Do you want to try without the fan? Sure? We'll try without the fan for a while. If you get hot, let me know, okay? All right? Okay. Yes. Yeah. We brought an engineer in from Germany to turn it off. He has a PhD. He'll be awesome. Okay. So it's good to see you again. A lot of changes. I'd like to welcome the new ordained people. Some people got married, probably some people got divorced, I don't know. Congratulations for that. And a lot of things like that. Anything, Mike? Can't hear still? Still can't hear. How's that? Better? No? Can you go any further? No? We also brought Madonna's son then in, so. How's that? Better? It's okay? Tony? Yeah. That's, all the rock stars do that. Okay. Alright, so we'll start. So we had a long trip, we got back last night, so a little spacey, but I think, I think you're going to get a report about it. We went to North Carolina first, did death meditation. That was about 2.5 months ago. Then went to California and tried to talk this guy into giving some cabins for Arizona and Connecticut. And looks like he will. And then we went to Australia. And we taught Bodhisattva vows to about 150 people. And did business seminars for about 350 people. And then did Mahamudra in Western Australia. And then we went to Mongolia, and that was a riot. There were about, between 800 to 1,000 people came every night. It was 5 nights in a row. It was on national TV. And it was a riot. It was just a riot. And they all mobbed everybody afterwards, and it was really cool. But this is the renaissance of Buddhism in Mongolia, I think. And it's starting with that, and they're very happy. So, you know, we'll talk more about it later, but they really want Americans to come and help them, especially Dharma-trained Americans, because they lost it for 70 years. And they're very excited to see Americans who can teach them, because they also love English. They want to learn English. So they're very, very excited. Like thousands and thousands of young people called the television station, and just incredible energy. So you got to think about that. They went to Ireland and gave really nice talks in Dublin and Galway. And I think we started a center there. And we started a center in Mongolia, Australia also. And that was really beautiful. And it's a beautiful mixture up there. It's a very interesting mixture of like Catholic, mystic, Druid, Celtic, Buddhism. And, and it was really, really powerful. And they're very excited. And so they begged us to come. We'll do another tour in the fall of Mongolia and Ireland, I think. They just insisted that we go back. So it was really beautiful. Then we went to Arizona, and it looks good for purchasing that land for a three-year retreat. We had a lot of meetings with developers and financiers and ranchers and cowboys and all sorts of things. But in the bottom line is I think it looks good to sign the contract in about a month. Winston's working really hard on it. And some developers from Ireland and Australia have volunteered to come and help there. These are people like who've done $100 million projects and things like that. So they're very excited and they've volunteered to help us. And the building is starting soon. And it looks like we'll be able to import yurts from Mongolia and have housing for anybody who wants to come for shorter periods of time. That was a big hurdle that we had, because otherwise it's tens of thousands of dollars. And now we can probably accommodate each person for about $1,000. In other words, you can have a semi-permanent building for like $1,000. And so that would accommodate more people. And the land is huge. It's about 5 miles square. And I think it's about the size of Manhattan or something. It's something like that, but it's beautiful. And there's lots of space. So the idea is that during the 3 years, you could just plop your yurt down and stay there for as long as you want and meditate and help with that. So we'll talk more about that as the time goes on, okay? But anyway, that was the trip in a nutshell. I think Christy wrote up a 10-page thing that you'll get handed it. And then I think we'll have a separate meeting about Arizona and things like that. But right now we got to get onto the diamond cutter. Now, the only thing I have to say about the rules of the class, which the sergeant has already covered, he really was a drill sergeant, you know, is I'm going to stick to the rule of miss two, more than two, and you're out, okay? So you must have your homework ready when you come into class. You must, you know, prepare your answers and everything. You must do the quizzes. That includes the people who hang out with me, okay? Must do it, or you cannot come to class, okay? We don't want a lineage of people who heard a quarter of it, or a third of it, or a half of it, okay? You have to pass it on completely, and you can't do that if you don't come to class, okay? So, must do your homework. If you miss more than two classes, you'll have to come back in November or something like that, all right? So we're going to be strict on that, like last time, okay? We'll be doing, in 10 classes, we'll be doing about a year's worth of work, okay? Five courses, it's about a year and a half. And so necessarily it'll be abbreviated somewhat, and we'll be just touching the main points. I always tell people that, you know, in the Geshe course, you spend 18 years learning these things. Then you take your final exams. I took my final exams right after finishing the first six courses or seven courses. It was a breeze. 1,500 people asking you questions in Tibetan in 7 days of debate. And it was easy because everything we've covered in class, okay? So you've done it all in class. What we will cover during this course is the main parts of those courses. You'll be getting the main questions in those courses, okay? And that's all that a Geshe remembers 2 years later, okay? But don't tell them I told you. Okay. The very first course that we're going to work on was number six in the 15 courses. It was the most important one, okay? That was the one on Diamond Cutter Sutra, okay? On emptiness. And we'll spend two classes on that. The next one is the most important one. So if you're going to drop this course, at least come to the next class. Okay, and then drop it after that. Okay, that's the one where we'll cover the direct perception of emptiness. Tonight, I just want to go over sort of an introduction of the Diamond Cutter Sutra. Okay, Sutra means a teaching that was spoken by Lord Buddha. Okay, this is a lecture that was given by Lord Buddha. And I want to explain a little bit about why it's called Diamond Cutter. Okay. Say Dorje? Chöpa. Dorje? Chöpa. By the way, if you've never been to these classes, you just have to know the English, okay? It's nice if you learn the pronunciation, you don't have to, all right? But I just put it here to put a blessing in your mind. And then maybe in 100 lifetimes, you'll start learning Tibetan or something, okay? Okay. Do means stone. Je means king. And that's why they call Tsongkhapa what? Je Tsongkhapa. It means the Lord or the king. Okay? Do Je means the king of stones, which is, of course, the diamond. Okay? Chöpa means cutter. And the whole thing in Sanskrit, which it's good to know, is Vajra. Chedaka. Vajra means diamond. The real pronunciation is Vajra. Okay? Chedaka means to cut, the cutter. Okay. I'd like to explain three meanings of diamond. This is maybe the most important thing in the 18 courses that you will ever hear. Okay? How many times did I say that? Anyway, I think it is the most important thing. Okay? Diamond has three meanings here. Okay? And you should know them. Okay? It's on your homework anyway. The first one, I think, is the most important one. If you look around the world for something which is ultimate, okay? Think about the idea of ultimate, which means the most of something, right? Like the ultimate mistake, or the ultimate credit card bill, or... You see what I mean? Think about those things. Ultimate means the most of something, the highest of something, the shortest of something, the most of something, if you think about it, okay? And in a sense, it's impossible, okay? The idea of ultimate is that there is no ultimate credit card bill. Someone could always spend a dollar more. You see what I mean? There is nobody who's ultimately tall or ultimately short. You could always cut them in half or add an inch. You see what I mean? And the idea of the most of anything in the physical world doesn't really exist. They talk about, cold zero, with absolute zero? I said, but there's not really absolute zero. You can make it colder, you know? And there's no edge to the universe. You can always go an inch farther. You see what I mean? There's no such thing. If you think about ultimate, try to imagine what ultimate means. Try to imagine something which is the most or the highest of anything, and you can't. Okay, there is no such thing in the physical world, really. Okay, we have things which are close, and the best of those is the diamond. Okay, if you studied about gems, which I did, you study the Mohs scale of hardness or the Knopf indentation test. But either way you do it, the diamond is something about 10,000 times harder than the next hardest thing. Okay? The next hardest thing, by the way, is ruby. In other words, if you tried to scratch it with something, you couldn't scratch it. Nothing can scratch a diamond. Nothing in the universe can scratch a diamond. Okay? So how do you cut diamonds? You actually take a diamond and crush it. You can crush them or you can cleave them, but you can't scratch them. You see what I mean? And you grind it up into a little powder and you put it on a diamond wheel. And then you hold the other diamond that you want to make into a diamond down on it really hard. And it starts to burn like red fluorescent. Like if you touch it, you get a really bad burn. And you're holding it on a steel plate. If you hold it the wrong way, it goes through the plate and destroys the plate. Because the plate steel is like 50,000 times softer than diamond, okay? And a few of the little diamond powder pieces are facing up and hit the diamond in the right direction and the diamond cleaves off like that. But you can't scratch a diamond with anything. You see what I mean? It's when some diamonds are so hard you just have to throw them out. It's kind of cool. Okay, very frustrating if you bought it. But it's like that in the diamond business. What's it got to do with emptiness, okay? The diamond is a metaphor for emptiness. When you see emptiness for the first time, directly, okay, which is a very major event, all right? I'll tell you some of the things you see. We'll talk about it more next class. You must come to the second class, okay? Very important. But in the space of maybe 20 minutes in deep meditation, you see emptiness directly, okay? That's called unsum. When you come out of that direct perception of emptiness, for the next 10 or 12 hours, you have extraordinary realizations. You see the day of your own enlightenment, okay? And very typically, this is seven lifetimes hence, okay? You understand that you have met the essence body of an enlightened being, okay? You understand prostration. You understand offering. You understand the idea of a tanka, for example, because you've met this being. You see what I mean? And things like that. I mean, it's extraordinary. 10 hours. You can read other people's minds for 4 or 5 hours, something like that. All these extraordinary events happen to you right after you see emptiness directly. And by the way, all of those events are organized into four things called the four noble truths. Okay, misnamed noble. Somebody translated Arya by mistake as noble. Okay, there are four groups of realizations that you have. These are called the four Arya realizations. Arya means somebody who has seen emptiness directly. Okay? So, right after you see emptiness, after you come out of that 20, 30 minutes of seeing emptiness directly, which you can't describe, Okay? But we'll talk about it. Then you, all these things, you see all these things directly. For the next 10 or 12 hours, you have these experiences directly. Okay? During that time, you are searching for some metaphor. You know, what is there in my normal life that was like what I saw? You know, I saw ultimate reality. I saw emptiness. What's the closest thing in the world to that? What do you think? It's diamond. Okay? Why? Because diamond is the closest thing in the world to something which is ultimate. Okay? Which is the most of anything. Why? It's the hardest thing. By about 10,000 times. Okay? In other words, you could pit a ruby against a diamond and hit them with each other, and 10,000 rubies would break before the diamond broke. You see what I mean? So diamond is by far the hardest thing. It's the closest thing in the natural universe to an ultimate. And when you see emptiness directly for the first time, after you come out of that experience, you're groping for some kind of metaphor. You know, you're looking for something to remind you of what you saw, because it was the most profound experience that a human can undergo. Okay? And you're groping for something that you can keep near you and keep remembering what you saw. So like, if you saw directly, you would come up with diamond, and then you would want to be around diamonds. Okay? Like, somehow you would want to be involved with diamonds. Like, and that would drive your life. Like, you'd be willing to spend the next 15 years, you know, working in some office to be around diamonds, just to be close to a diamond so you could remember. For no other reason. Just to remember those 20 minutes. You would be willing to work in some stupid place for 8 hours a day just to remember those 20 minutes for 15 years of your life. You know what I mean? It's worth it. Okay? It's an amazing experience, and you have to remember it. Okay? That's why this diamond is important. That's why the diamond is in the title. Okay? That's the first reason. Okay? Why do we compare emptiness to a diamond? Because a diamond is something which is ultimate. Okay? Second thing. Every object in the universe has its own emptiness, okay? This pen has its emptiness. The chair you're sitting on has its emptiness. The last hair on your left eyebrow has its own emptiness, okay? The last thought you had has its own emptiness. Your mind has its own emptiness. New York City has its own emptiness, okay? Emptiness has its own emptiness, all right? Everything has emptiness, okay? But you can't see it. You see, 20 minutes and your life is over. 20 minutes and you have dang. Dang means insurance policy. Definite, gonna be out in 7 lifetimes, you know. Perfectly, absolutely sure. Saw the day of your enlightenment. Know what they're gonna call you, what they're not gonna call you. Saw directly, okay? All you need to do is see it for 20 minutes. And you're sitting there in an ocean of emptinesses. There's millions of emptinesses in this room. Every object in this room has its own emptiness. The end of the last hair on your left eyebrow has its own emptiness. And the root has its own. You see what I mean? It's endless. And you can't see them. If you could see it for 10, 20 minutes, you'd be out of here. You see what I mean? So emptiness is like all around you. Emptiness is clear. Okay? Emptiness is invisible. Normal people cannot see emptiness. Okay? You must have some extraordinary preparation to see it. Okay? So it's an interesting thing about diamond. Diamond is so pure that if I put a wall of diamond between me and you that was 100 feet wide or a mile wide, you wouldn't see it. Diamond is that pure. Now, glass is not pure. Glass has iron in it. You set a pane of glass and look down the end, what do you see? You see green, because iron takes the blue and the yellow and the red. I don't know. Anyway, green comes out. Okay? That's because of impurities in the glass. If you turn the glass this way, you can see through it. But if I had a wall of diamond between you and me that was 5 miles thick, you would still see me perfectly well. Okay? It's so pure that it's invisible. It's totally invisible. Okay? And that's the second meaning of diamond. Okay? Diamond, emptiness is around you constantly. You don't see it. You can't see it. Okay? What is it that lets you see it? By the way, that's why those deities have this third eye here. Lobsang Rumpa had one drilled in. You don't have to drill it in. You can get one the old way, okay? That eye is seeing emptiness. The eye represents seeing emptiness. To see emptiness, you have to have an extraordinary amount of virtue, good deeds, okay? Like, examples would be like building a house for your lama or something like that, or serving sick people for decades, or studying scripture, or helping refugee monks, or things like that. You need some kind of extraordinary virtue. You need an excellent, authentic teacher to show you how to do it. You must have great books to learn it from. It's very similar to learning to play concert piano. And it's about that difficult. If you don't spend the time every day to prepare yourself to see emptiness, about the same amount of time that a person spends to learn to play at, what's that place? Carnegie Hall. Seriously. Then you won't make it. You won't see it in this lifetime. Okay? What if you don't see it? Or you just die like everybody else. Okay? Really. You die and there. This is one mind state. The mind state, you're looking at me, you have a certain mind state. You had a certain mind state to get to this class. That's one in millions and millions of mind states. There are millions and millions of other options of mind states. And there are millions of other beings that you can see and you can't see, and they have other mind states. Okay? You become one of those. Like the odds of being here now are about 1 in 200 million or something. Okay? You've succeeded in getting here. Okay? You have that mind state. If you die, you lose it. Okay? You have to go to one of the other mind states. Animal, insect, bug, anything. Doesn't matter. You will go to another mind state. There's not a... I'll talk about it later. There's not one single shred of evidence that's convincing that the mind stops when the body stops. I got tired of people asking me, oh, you're Buddhist. Can you prove future lives? I say, you're not Buddhist. You prove to me there are no future lives. I'm tired of it, okay? You prove to me that the mind stops. Oh, the body stops. Oh yeah, well, trucks break down, so drivers die, right? I mean, it doesn't make any sense at all. Okay, the body stops twitching. That doesn't say anything about the mind. Okay, forget it. It doesn't convince anything. 2,000 years ago they made this argument, and Dharmakirti said, come on, that's stupid. But that doesn't prove anything. Okay, how do you know that the mind stops? You see? You don't know. Oh, the guy stopped talking. Yeah, his machine broke. He can't talk to you. It doesn't prove he's not alive. It doesn't prove he can't think, okay? That's the only proof Western society has, actually. And it's dumb. You must go on. It's the only mind state in which you can see emptiness is the one you have right now. Okay, you have to do it now, okay? You have to try to do it now. If you do it now, everything is taken care of forever. If you don't do it now, you have to come back here in 1 million years, 2 million years, hear this whole stuff again. Who wants to do those courses all over again? Okay. Third reason emptiness is like diamond. Third reason they use the word diamond. If you take a diamond, as you've seen on TV, you know, you can cleave diamonds, which means you create a little notch in them, like with a laser, or you find a natural notch, and you take a diamond which is fatter, or you go bock. And you force it in and it cracks, it cleaves, okay? So you can actually smash a diamond into thousands of pieces. The old De Beers mine in South Africa, these poor guys would come up with these big diamonds and ask the appraiser, how much is this worth? He'd say, that's not a diamond. That's just quartz, you know? And it was a diamond. And the guy would take a hammer and tap it, you know, and it would fall into pieces. He'd say, look, it broke, it's not a diamond. The guy would leave and then he'd pick up all the pieces from under the table, you know? Anyway. There's lots of diamond stories. So you can cleave a diamond. In other words, you can separate diamond into tiny parts. We call it Dorje Sigma. It means tiny, tiny pieces of diamond. Okay. The nice thing about diamond is that no matter how many times you cut it, each piece of diamond is pure diamond. 100% pure, absolute, clean, perfect diamond. If you smash it down to molecular level, down to single molecules, each molecule is perfect diamond. Okay? What's that got to do with emptiness? We said that every object in this room has its own emptiness. The chairs, the people, your hair, your lack of hair has its own emptiness. Okay? Each thing has its own emptiness. Okay? And they're all 100% equal emptiness. Okay? That's all. You know, what do you call it? Content-wise, they're all perfectly 100% equal. When an enlightened being sees emptiness, and when a normal schmuck like us sees emptiness for the first time, that's 100% perception of emptiness. It's no different at all, okay? The direct perception of emptiness is the same, okay? Nothing can be half emptiness, or 75% emptiness, or 85% empty. It's pure 100% sheer emptiness, okay? And what that means, we'll get into later, okay? But the third point is that take a diamond, smash it, every piece is 100% diamond, okay? Take all the emptinesses in this room, each one is totally equal. 100% devoid of what? A self-existent thing. What's a self-existent thing mean? Do you like this pen? Do you like this pen? Hey, some people do, some people don't. Okay? Some people do, some people don't. So the goodness of this pen or the badness of this pen is not something that belongs to the pen. The pen has no nature of being good or bad from its own side. Okay? That's obvious. You don't need to be a philosopher to understand that. Okay? There's no quality in this pen of being a bad pen or a good pen from its own side. You's making it that way. Okay? Something about you. Something in your mind is saying, I like that pen. Something in your mind is saying, I don't like that pen. Something in your mind is saying, I could care less about that pen. I don't know why he's getting into that. Okay? I mean, everybody has their own feeling about the pen. The point is, there's no goodness or badness about the pen itself. Okay? It's not like it's coated with good and that coating is like showing itself to everybody. Okay? It's not like that. You are sending something to it. You are imposing something on it. It's just a plain old neutral innocent pen. And you're thinking good or bad, okay? So the goodness or the badness doesn't come from the pen's own side. That's its emptiness, okay? That's no big philosophy thing. You don't have to worry about anything. You don't have to go close your eyes real tight. You're trying to see something black, but these green or purple spots keep coming up, okay? It's not like that. It has nothing to do with that, okay? The pen doesn't have its own. It is devoid or empty of any nature of its own as far as being good or bad. That's all. Okay? It's empty. Okay. What would be a self-existent thing? Oh, a pen which was good from its own side, or a pen which was bad from its own side. By the way, if it were self-existently good from its own side, if it had a nature of being good from its own side, then every person who ever saw it would say what? A great pen. Great pen. Okay? If it was bad from its own side, you know, if it was like emanating rays of badness, then everybody who looked at it would say, ooh, I hate that pen. I hate that pen. Okay? If you want to know what a self-existent thing would be like, that's it. Okay? How many self-existent things exist? Zero. Okay? None. Okay? It can't have that. Okay? But, you know, they make a joke in Tibet. They say, imagine a purple two-headed elephant 50 feet high rampaging through this school auditorium at this moment. Okay? Close your eyes. Imagine. Now, Kieran, you can imagine rampaging through the kid, okay? But you can't imagine an elephant like that, right? I mean, you can imagine it, but you can't see it really happening, right? That elephant and the goodness of this pen have the same ontological status. They are equally existing, meaning they don't exist at all, okay? Santa Claus, you know, the Tooth Fairy, and pens which are good. No, they all belong to the same status. They have the same status, which is zero. Okay? There is no pen which is good. Okay? Where is it coming from? Your mind. You're imposing something on it. Okay? That's all. That's the emptiness of this pen. You don't have to go any farther than that. Okay? That's the emptiness of this pen. And that's a self-existent thing. Next question on your homework. Oh. Sorry. We finished diamond. Three meanings of diamond. Now, why call it diamond cutter? Like a lot of early translators got lazy and called this book what? The Diamond Sutra. Like, who needs that cutter? Okay? Okay. The real name is Vajracchedika, diamond cutter. What's the cut mean? The cut is this. I mean, when you come out of the direct perception of emptiness and you have seen your own enlightenment, you know, that's a pretty amazing thing. And then you're grappling, you know, what's a metaphor for that emptiness? And you come up with diamond, okay? You know that diamond is the closest thing. You know you should spend the rest of your life close to diamonds and near diamonds. But you equally realize something else. It ain't even close, okay? It's close and no cigar, okay? Like, it's very close. It's the closest thing in the universe to emptiness is diamond. How close is it? Not at all. A billion light years away, okay? I mean, ultimate reality, meaning emptiness. and the reality we see here are a zillion miles apart. A zillion miles apart. There are two realities. You are sitting in one of them now. You are swimming in a certain reality right now. You've never touched the other one. It's a million miles that way. You see that one, and it's all over. You just see it for 20 minutes, and it's all over. Two vastly different levels of reality. Okay? So you can say, oh, hey, Michael Roach, what's the closest thing to emptiness that you can think of? Diamond. How close is it? Not at all. Okay? So in that sense, the diamond is cut. And that's why they call it diamond cutter. The idea is that diamond is the closest thing, and diamond is vastly inferior to the real thing, the real McCoy, which is ultimate reality. Totally different level of reality. Totally different. You can understand the emptiness of the pen that I just explained. You have only perceived emptiness intellectually when I get through with that. Okay? If you go on and meditate and see it directly, it's a whole different reality. Completely different level of reality. You see that reality for 20 minutes, you will be an enlightened being within a certain amount of time. That's all. Okay? It's incredible. You have to try. The reason we're having this class, you have to come out of here saying, I have these people write me from California every few weeks. I'm trying, you know. You have to try to see this thing. It's the only thing that can save you. Okay? You have to try to see it. Okay? That's the purpose of this class. It's really the purpose of the whole institute, is to get you to see emptiness directly. By the way, to do that, you have to be meditating a lot, so it'd be nice to be in a nice, quiet, super quiet place. Okay? For a while. And that's the whole reason to do the thing in Arizona. No other reason at all. Try to get people into seeing emptiness directly. You must have a quiet place. You must concentrate on it. You have to be locked up and try. Before that, you have to have about 15 courses. Okay? Alright. So that's why they call it diamond cutter. Because diamond is close, but it's cut or it's inferior by the real thing. Okay? Narai Gacha. Say Gacha.
Gacha.
Gacha. Some people it's easy to remember if they think of Gacha. Okay? Anyway. Gak means to stop or deny. When you hang somebody in Tibet, you say gak. Okay? Gakja means the thing to be gaked, the thing to be stopped. Here it means the thing we deny, the thing we deny. The thing we say, hey, stupid, that doesn't exist. Okay? What is it? A pen which could be good from its own sign. By the way, the old translations of Buddhism said self. They left out the nature. So everybody went around thinking they shouldn't be themselves. And I don't know whose teeth they were brushing in the morning, but, okay? Forget all that, okay? Big mistake, stupid translation. Does this thing have a self? No, it's not a person. Does it have a self nature? Yes, it does, it's a pen. Does it have a self nature in and of itself, of being good, for example? No, it doesn't have that kind of self nature. That's all they meant when they said no self, okay? They meant no nature of its own. No quality of being good or bad of it in and of itself, by itself. Okay? That doesn't exist. Okay? That's the gacha. Okay? Gacha means, get this. Gacha means the thing that emptiness is empty of. Got it? If you say my pocket's empty, what is it empty of? Enough money to buy a Michael and Zoe's fruit shake. Okay? That would be the gacha. You see what I mean? When you speak of emptiness or voidness, you say, void of what? Empty of what? You see? His head is totally empty. Empty of what? Brains. Okay? Alright? What is this empty of? Gacha. You see? That's what gacha means. The thing that's not there. Okay? The thing that emptiness is empty of. A thing which could exist from its own side in and of itself. A goodness or badness of this pen which is emanating out to every person so everybody likes it the same. How many of those are there? Zero. They don't exist. They're the same as the Tooth Fairy, Santa Claus, and the self-existence of the goodness of this pen. Okay? They just don't exist. Okay? So why talk about something that doesn't exist? You know, why don't we talk about Santa Claus instead of spending the whole lecture on Buddhist philosophy. You see? Because they have equal reality, which is zero. You see what I mean? You might as well talk about anything. We had this huge debate in the monastery, trying to debate about whether you could describe a thing that doesn't exist. You see, you can't. They're all equal. You could say 10-foot purple elephant smashing through this room, 20-foot, 30-foot, 1,000-foot. It doesn't matter. They're all equally zero. They don't exist. Okay. The thing that this is empty of is a pen, which is good from its own side, bad from its own side. That just plain doesn't exist. That's gaccha. Okay. You have to know that. All the texts say, Shantideva is the most famous one, which means you can't establish what emptiness means. You can't get to enlightenment in 7 lifetimes unless you know what emptiness is empty of. You see what I mean? What is it that's not there? A pen that could exist from its own side. That's all. Okay. All right? Gotcha. Let me see. Let's do one more, okay, and then we'll stop. We'll take a break. No one's asked me the famous Mrs. Ribush question. Who's Mrs. Ribush? There's this brilliant monk named, ex-monk, Nick Ribush, who started Wisdom Publications. Great Dharma student, last 30, 40 years. I think the main thing he's done is converted a bunch of other people, too. But so I was giving this lecture in Melbourne, and Mrs. Ribush calls me up. This is his mother, 85 years old, something like that. She calls me up. I have to meet you. So okay, tomorrow at your place. I said, okay. You know, and she comes in, and she can hardly walk, and there's this lady carrying her, and she sits down, and she says, I was at your lecture. You know, I said, yeah, I know. She says, I want to know something about the pen. I said, okay, ask me. She says, you know, you were talking about the goodness of the pen or the badness of the pen. What about the pen itself? Okay? What about the pen itself? Does the pen itself have the nature of being a pen or not? You see what I mean? Good or bad is easy. What about penness? Does it have a nature of being a pen from its own side? Which is to say, would every single living being who ever walked in this room, roach, dog, bird, human, Eskimo from the 14th century, would they all look at it and say, oh, dry erase marker, boon, medium color? Would they all say that? No. Which means even its penness is something being projected on it by you. Okay? Otherwise, dogs could walk in here and start riding. You know, birds could walk in here and ride something. You know what I mean? They would recognize it as a writing instrument. You see what I mean? It's not even a writing instrument from its own side. Get it? To a bird or a roach or a dog, it's just another cylinder. It's a pretty one. It shines. It's just a pretty black and white cylinder. They can't cognize it as a pen. You know? They can't use it as a pen. They don't see it as a pen. Even its penness is something that you are laying on it. Okay? Where does that come from? We say karma. That's the meaning of karma. Okay? In the past, history of your mind, which has never died, get it? Which has been around for a long, long time. You helped someone write something. You did something for someone to give them a pen, supply them with something written. Okay? And that put a seed in your mind to see pens. And now in this life, by the way, you think it's natural, right? Oh, all those things are pens. I'm not projecting that. That's coming from the pen. You even call it a pen. You don't say, oh, nice black and white cylinder, Michael. Okay? You say it's a pen. You believe it's a pen from its own side. That's wrong. Okay? It's a conditioned thing. You are laying it. You are putting it on the cylinder. You're putting pen on the cylinder. If it wasn't that way, and if it was a pen from its own side, then every single being who ever walked in here would say, hey, let me use that to write a letter. Woof, woof, woof. You know, let me write a letter with that thing. Okay? It's not true. Okay? It's not even a pen from its own side. Okay? You got to get used to that. Now, in the Diamond Cutter Sutra, Lord Buddha says, and by the way, when you yourself get to an enlightened being, it's all that way. It's all the same. Okay? Meaning what? when you get to be a Buddha, you know, finally, after all those classes, okay, memorizing all those stupid dakyes. Rinpoche said the best thing about the dakye is when you get enlightened, you don't have to recite anymore. You know? Okay, anyway, so after all this work, what's going to happen to this cylinder? Two cylinders here, okay? Here's one, which is just a plain old cylinder. If you have karma in your mind to see it as a pen, you see it as a pen. Guess what? This one's the same. This cylinder here is just the same, okay? You have pretty good karma in your mind, you'll see it as a human arm. You have crappy karma in your mind, you'll see it as a dog's foot. And then you will be a dog. This rebirth stuff is serious. It's just perceptions. They don't make dog bodies out in Nebraska somewhere and stuff minds into them. It's just a perception, okay? Your mind can turn on you in 10 seconds. It's called dying. And you'll see it differently a minute later. At any moment it can happen. This rebirth stuff is serious stuff, very dangerous stuff, okay? It's not that your mind floats around, flop, 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 and it goes to Nebraska and finds a dog body factory and they stuff it in there and sew it real quick or something like that. It's not like that. Your mind shifts slightly. Your perception shifts very slightly. And instead of an arm, you're seeing a leg. Okay? Instead of an ear, you're seeing an antenna. And then you are a dog. You are an insect. You see, it's very serious. It's very possible. The thing called death itself is just another perception. The thing you used to see moving, now you're forced by your old karma to see it not moving. That's called death. It happens in a minute or so. And don't think that you're like exempt from being those other kinds of beings. You're not. All it takes is a slight shift in your mind, and you are that being. You see what I mean? Because then you see this cylinder differently. What's that got to do with the Diamond Cutter Sutra? Now that you're ready for dessert, I mean refreshments. Sorry. The point is this. If you could put some really, really, really pure karma in your mind, okay, mainly in this lifetime, your only real shot is tantric practice, okay? If you could put some kind of heavy, heavy good karma in your mind, then in this lifetime, before you die, maybe you have a shot to see this as an enlightened being's arm. Okay? That's all. Maybe you have a chance. Okay? If you practice very seriously, very hard, the highest practices, you have some chance of seeing this cylinder and this cylinder as something different. You see what I mean? There's nothing human about this cylinder from its own side. I'm imposing that on this. Okay? If I change the karma in my mind by being very, very holy, very good to others, then I might be able to see this thing change before I die. That's what tantric practice is all about. We're going to talk more about it later. You have to try in this lifetime to try to pull it off. Okay? What happens then? Your mind is forcing you to see four new things about you. Okay? These are called the four bodies of the Buddha. You have to write them down because they're on your homework. Okay. And everybody should know the four bodies of the Buddha. By the way, sometimes it's taught as three, sometimes it's taught as four. When you teach it as three, you're really just grouping two of the four into one. Okay? So don't get worried about it. I'm going to teach it to you the more detailed way. All right? But what we're talking about is how you're going to become a tantric enlightened being in this lifetime. Four things are going to happen to this arm and to this mind. Okay? Here's the first one. They call them bodies. They shouldn't call them parts or body parts. I don't know. Body number one. I don't like the word body much. You should have called it the four parts of an enlightened being or something like that. I mean, most translators like Thupten Jinpa now is using part or something. You see what I mean? Say ngō. Niku. Ngō. Niku. This is the most important part of an enlightened being, and it's the most difficult part of an enlightened being. Ngō ni means emptiness. Okay? Lo ni is another word for emptiness. Okay? This whole first part here, lo ni, means emptiness. Ku means part or body. The part of an enlightened being, which is their emptiness. This is the coolest part of an enlightened being. This is the most important part of an enlightened being. Okay? Why? Check this out. The fact that this thing, the fact that this cylinder is not a human arm from its own side, any more than this is good from its own side. Get it? You've got to keep it in mind. These two things are the same. Okay? This thing is not good or bad or even a pen from its own side. This thing is not a human arm from its own side. I'm imposing that on this cylinder. I'm forced to see it as an arm. By whom? Mr. Karma. Okay? Mr. Karma is twisting this arm, so I see this arm as an arm. Mr. Karma is forcing me to see this. By the way, you don't have any choice right now. Your karma was set. You did certain things. You said certain things. You thought certain things. They're imprinted into your mind. You don't have a choice now. Okay? You can sit there and say, I wish it wasn't a human arm, but it's not going to change it. Okay? Your karma is forcing you to see this cylinder as a human arm. Okay? But there's a potential here. What's the potential? It could be a tantric angel's arm. Why? It's empty. It doesn't have its own nature. Any more than this is good or bad from its own side. There's this incredible potential. There's this thing called good luck. What? Thank God. This thing is empty. Okay? Thank goodness this thing is empty. Okay? If this was an arm from its own side, you'd be stuck forever until the day it got more wrinkled and died. Okay? But since it's empty, you have a shot. Okay? It doesn't have any nature of being an arm from its own side. Okay? It doesn't have any nature from its own side. Everything about it is coming from your mind. And your mind is being driven, whipped by karma. Hey, see it this way. Okay? No choice. Right now. That's why you have to be good, because then you have different karma set in your mind, and you'll see it differently. Okay? But what's our saving grace? What's the only good thing about our present arm? Is it the blood? Is it the bone? Is it the cancer cells probably already running around getting ready? You know, both my parents were dead by this age. Like, I'm just waiting, you know? Okay? What's the only good thing about your arm? What's the only saving grace about your arm? It's empty. It has potential. Okay? It's not fixed. It's like an empty screen. If you fix the projector, you'll have a nice tantric deity's arm. Okay? That's the saving grace of your arm. By the way, that's the only thing you can take with you to the bank. It's the only part of you which will still be there when you achieve enlightenment. Okay? You won't have the same hair, eye, brain, nose, ear, foot, anything. But your emptiness, you get to take with you all the way. So we call that what? Buddha nature. Buddha nature. Okay? And all those people who say that Buddha nature is this little guy that's hiding under your fourth rib somewhere, and you just have to scrape off enough skin or something, it's all stupid. Okay? Buddha nature means every piece of you and every piece of your mind and every piece of your body is empty. It doesn't have a nature of being one way or the other, from its own side. So if you could just clean up your karmic act, you would see it as a tantric deity's arm. That's cool. That's its emptiness. Okay? And that emptiness you carry all the way to enlightenment. And when you get enlightened, the emptiness of your mind and the emptiness of your body is called the emptiness body. Okay? The emptiness body. Or sometimes they call it the essence body. Okay? That's all. So the most important part of Buddha, the part of a Buddha that allows them to be a Buddha, is their emptiness. Okay? That's all. That's the first body of a Buddha. That's the most important one. I always do the most difficult one first because then you'll pay attention to the others. Here's number two. The sergeant's been waving at me. I think he says there's enough orange juice for everybody. Okay. Say longku. Longku. By the way, I'm going to give you the... Should I give you the... Nah, forget that. Okay. Longku means the physical body of an enlightened being in their own paradise, in their own heaven. Okay? Like, it's very cool because, to tell you the truth, whatever you are attracted to now, it'll be a variant of that that you will be. It's very interesting. Like whatever you find physically most attractive in the whole universe, you'll be very close to that. Okay? Like if you're attracted to Tara, you'll look a little bit like Tara. If you're attracted to, I don't know, Baywatch ladies or something. No, I'm not kidding. I'm not kidding. You will be the most beautiful thing you can imagine. Okay? 10 times better, 1 billion times better. But it's funny, you will be some kind of take on that. Okay? It's very interesting. Whatever you're most attracted to now, your deity body, the body that you enjoy and some longings enjoy, the body that you enjoy in your own paradise, we call it the paradise body, okay? That one will be about 1 billion times better than the most beautiful thing you can imagine right now, the thing you're most attracted to, okay? You have a seed for it already. You have a certain attraction towards that kind of physical form already. Just be 1 billion times better, no blood, no guts, pure light. But you will look like that being, okay? Okay, that's in its own paradise. Number 3. Say tulku. Tulku. Sometimes this word is corrupted to tulku, okay? Because people can't say ta, which is not so bad, okay? You can say tulku, tulku, doesn't matter. Tul means to emanate. Tul means to emanate. This is the emanation body. What does that mean? 1 millisecond after you achieve enlightenment, you appear in billions of planets as billions of different people and animals to help other people. Okay? That's the nature of an enlightened being. Okay? 1 millisecond after your enlightenment. By the way, in the first moment of enlightenment, how many bodies do you have? Just 3. Okay? 1 millisecond later, you get a tulku. Tulku means the ability in a single moment to project bodies onto billions of planets to help billions of people. All at once. And sungidrupa means what? Spontaneously. No conscious thought. You're not even aware of it going on. Okay? You just show up on billions of planets. You, bodies. It could also be something inanimate. Trees, bridges, ships, cars. Okay? The Buddha has this ability. Okay? So you're sitting up in your paradise with your, what? Your lonku, okay? Your paradise body. And then you've got all these other forms appearing on billions of planets. Okay? To anyone who is ready, that's the catch, okay? First Dalai Lama, Abhidhamma Kosha commentary, Talam Zelje, opening pages. Hey, if there's all these tukus around, how come I didn't bump into one? You gotta have enough good karma. And lots of people don't. Okay? How many tukus around you right now? How many of your friends are in drag? You know? You don't know. Okay? I mean, everybody in this room could be. I'm not. Okay? But everybody in this room could be a tuku. Everybody in New York except you or me could be a tuku. Okay? You don't know. Okay. But anyway, you gotta have a lot of virtue to see a tuku. Then there's, you know, like Coke Classic? There's a classic tuku. Okay? Described in the 8th chapter of the Abhisamalankara. That is the physical body of Lord Buddha Shakyamuni, who appeared in India 2,500 years ago. You know, they have 32 major marks, 80 minor marks. They have certain set of marks on their body. They have a little thing here, they got dharma wheels here, they got bump on their head, they got long ears. You see, that's called the classic tuku. That shows up on a planet once in every couple thousand years or less, okay? And then there's all the other mini tukus, okay? Emanation bodies. That could be a car, a dog, the person sitting next to you in the subway that you didn't like this afternoon, all trying to bring you to enlightenment, okay? All working. They could have been on that subway for 20 years waiting for you to get on. Okay, for them it's nothing. We're talking people who have been enlightened for 1 billion years. No, okay, 20 years, I gotta wait for Christina to get on the subway. Okay. So I can shove her. You know. No, I'm not kidding. Somebody did it to me this morning. So I, you know, this guy says he's teaching patience and then he gets pissed off within 30 seconds. One good shove, you know. Okay, that's all. They're all around you, they're helping you. They're testing you. Okay. You guessed, right? Say yeshe.
Yeshe.
Chuku.
Chuku.
Yeshe.
Yeshe.
Chuku.
Chuku.
Yeshe means wisdom. A lot of Tibetans are named yeshe. Chuku means like Dharma body. Dharma body. Yeshe Chuku means just simply the ultimate wisdom of an enlightened being. Okay? The omniscience of an enlightened being. Enlightened beings have the power to see everything that ever was, everything that ever will be, everything that is now in the entire universe in 1 millisecond. They can see all of them directly. Okay? They see all of history that ever was or ever will be on every planet in the universe every second that they're alive. They see it. Okay? This is omniscience. All the thoughts and all the minds of all the beings that ever lived, will live, did live, period. They see it all within it. That's what makes them so good at helping people. Okay? It's like a goal that we can strive. By the way, does omniscience imply omnipotence? No. Whatever those people say. Okay? Come on. Who's killing all these people with cancer? Who's burning little babies in buildings? Okay? Who's letting Kosovo go? They, you know, it can't be an enlightened being. It can't be a compassionate being. There's no such thing. Okay? There is no omnipotent being. We don't believe that. Are there omniscient beings? Of course there are. Are they surrounding you all the time, watching you, trying to help you? Yes. Do they emanate all your friends and, you know, all your enemies too? Yes, maybe. Okay? Are they very powerful? Yes. Do they have ultimate love for you? Yes. Do they constantly guide you and help you even though you can't see them? Yes. Are they omnipotent? No. Why? AIDS, cancer, car accidents, babies dying in fires that didn't have time to be bad yet. Okay? It's obvious. Okay? So Buddha does not have omnipotence. Buddha has omniscience. Okay? So that's the fourth body. Okay? Yeah? Yeah, right, right, right. We did define it that way. That's called Bhamshe. Bhamshe means a useful way of describing it. Technically, it's the ability to see everything in the universe at the same time. But what makes omniscience sexy is that omniscience can decide what's good and what's bad for getting you enlightened. Okay? I don't care if omniscient knows every kind of, you know, boll weevil in the world and can name them all for me. It doesn't matter. I mean, the function of omniscience is to teach people what's right and what's wrong for getting to be omniscient or enlightened. You see, that's the value of omniscience. It's not that, oh, gee, I can tell you the 14 different kinds of, you know, bugs that live at the bottom of this kind of... I don't care, okay? But if you say I can come and describe to you in 15 minutes how to get your rear end into a paradise, or, you know, what kinds of karma to do and what kinds of karma not to do, well, that becomes interesting. That's all. The main reason to admire or want to be omniscient is that. Okay. Please have some refreshments and we'll start in about 10 minutes. Okay. Anyway, there's a short spiel in there about the perfection of giving. You know, what is it to give perfectly? Okay. What the perfection of giving is not is that you give something and it works out great. Okay. That's not it. Frankly, when you do a virtue, you can't predict the result in the short term. The apparent result is unpredictable. You give somebody $100, they go out, buy a gun, shoot their parents. You know, you can't predict the apparent, what we call the apparent result. But you can always predict the ultimate result, okay, which is that if you give, so shall ye get, you know? And that's the result of that. So it's important during an act of giving. Buddha says something like, there are three elements in an act of giving and do not see them. Okay? There are three parts to an act of giving and do not see them. And we have to discuss what do not see them means. Okay? But first we have to figure out what are the three parts. So here's the three parts. Say jinje.
Jinje.
Jinje. Jinje means the person giving the thing. Jin means to give, je means doer. The person giving the thing. So the subject in this action, the person who's giving something, is called jinje. Can you see the jinje? If I give this piece of paper to Venerable Ann, our newest venerable, can Can you see the person who gives it? Of course you can. I'm standing here. Okay? But can you see me in a self-existent way? Can you see me independent of your own karma forcing you to see me the way you see me? By the way, if you think I'm ugly, that's your problem. I'm not kidding. I'm really not kidding. It's your karma projected onto me. I'm not ugly from my own side. I'm not handsome from my own side. You got to get used to that. Any way you perceive your teacher especially is totally your problem. Okay? It's your karma. Okay? Anyway, that's what it means not to see the person who's giving. You see what I mean? That's Jinje. That's the emptiness of the element of the giver. Okay? And you have to think about that when you give something. Okay? What does it mean in terms of yourself doing the perfection of giving? If you give little pieces of food to birds on the street in New York City, but you are thinking about that emptiness thing and thinking about this arm turning into Manjushri's arm or Tara's arm or Baywatch arm or whatever you're going to do, okay? If you're concentrating on that, it all happens a lot faster. Okay? So if you give a scrap of food to a sparrow on the street in New York City, but you're concentrating on that emptiness thing of you, the giver, much more powerful. Much, much more powerful. You have a good chance of getting enlightened soon. You see, that's the perfection of giving as opposed to ignorant giving. Because you're thinking about the emptiness of the person who's giving. Okay? Next one. Jinyu. Say Jin.
Yu.
Jinyu. Jinyu means the person to whom you're giving something. Jin means giving, Yu means the person to whom you're giving it. The indirect object, if you will. Okay? And again, you give this piece of paper to Venerable Dr. Sides. Okay? And while you're giving it, you think, you know, if I had better karma, I'd be seeing Manjushri. Okay? Now, I see a very holy being, but not quite Manjushri. Okay? Yeah. And that's my fault. You see what I mean? Okay. No, and that's my fault. I don't have the karma yet. You see? I'm projecting a human being, a normal human being. Okay? That's my fault. If I were more pure, if my mind were more pure, I'd be perceiving an enlightened being. Okay? So that's the emptiness of the person to whom you're giving something. Say Jimba.
Jimba.
Jimba. Jimba means the whole act of giving. The fact that Dr. Sykes is there, Venerable Dr. Sykes. The fact that I'm here. The fact that we're interacting. It's not a coincidence. There are no accidents in Buddhism. Okay? That event of the giving itself is also empty. Okay? The fact that it's happening is a projection of my mind. Okay? The fact that he sat there, the fact that I'm standing here, the fact that I have something to give him, the whole ambiance of the thing is due to my karma. Okay? I'm seeing the whole thing happen because of my karma. Alright? And that's the emptiness of the act of giving. Now there's one last part. And then we're finished with the easy stuff. Say Jinja.
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 Jinja means the thing that you give, okay? The piece of paper is the Jinja. So how many elements of an act of giving do we have? But there's only three. Some scriptures replace any one of the first three with the fourth one that I gave you, okay? So I'm just giving it to you for dessert, all right? Usually just the first three that you see here. Sometimes different scriptures throw in number four and they skip one of the first three. So it gives you more flexibility on your homework, okay? So anyway, the Jinja is the thing I'm giving to Dr. Sykes, okay? If my karma, it is also empty. If my karma had been different, he would have been Donald Trump. You know, I would have had a contract that said, we're moving you into the World Trade Center tomorrow. Okay, something like that. All right, that's all. It's the emptiness of the paper. After this, this paper is much more valuable, right? It's got the four bodies on it. Okay? That's all. Emptiness of the giver, emptiness of the givee, emptiness of the giving, and emptiness of the thing you're giving. Okay? And if you keep your mind on those while you give something, that's why you can get enlightened giving food to birds. Okay? You don't have to save 3,000 people on a Titanic in the middle of the Atlantic or something. Okay? They say you can get enlightened giving food to birds. Why? Because if you keep all this stuff in mind, you know, I have to see myself as a normal person because I don't have the good enough karma yet. I have to see him as a normal, beautiful, holy monk because I don't have the karma to see him as Manjushri yet. You know, I have the karma to see myself given this paper instead of $1 million, sorry. Because I don't have the karma yet. That's all. The emptiness of all the things going on. And I met him and he's here and I'm here and I'm giving it to him because of my karma also. Everything is your projection. Everything around you is the same. Yeah? Oh, it's nothing very logical, okay? Just sometimes there's nobody, well, most often it replaces the one about the thing being given. For example, in the perfection of patience, there's nothing exchanged. You see what I mean? So that then they say the guy being patient, the guy you're being patient at, and the act of patience itself. And there's no particular object being exchanged or something, okay? So sometimes it will replace that one. Okay, last thing. We've been going through each time at the very end and talking about what? Huh? Future of Dharma in America. Future of Buddhism in America. So I think it's important. I think in the last year of reviewing these courses, we have to talk about how do you teach those courses. You see what I mean? And subjects we've talked about so far were like stuff like, what are you going to teach? And who's qualified to teach it? And should you charge or shouldn't you charge? And how are you going to keep track of your finances? And how are you going to certify that teachers are real? What kind of books are you going to say are good books and what kind of books are not good books and things like that? And we've been talking about all the details of how to spread a new path in this country. And sooner or later, it has to be brought up. You can either do it in a random way, or you can actually sit like this together and say, okay, we want our Buddhism to be like this. We want to avoid these mistakes from the old country. We want to enhance these things from the old country. And we want to keep very preciously this ancient wisdom that's been passed down to us by the Tibetans, very non-corrupt. You see what I mean? It's very, very pure lineage. So how do we do that? I had one sponsor. I said, if you give me $20 million, I can spread Buddhism all over America. They said, sounds great. Can you promise me that in 100 years it won't be like such and such a church? You know? I said, no. They said, okay, I won't give you the money. Anyway, how are you going to guarantee that this tradition is as pure as it is now, 100 years or 200 years from now? You see, I mean, this is a big question. You have to plan for it now, before it takes off. It's taking off already. So you have to see, how are you going to keep it pure? How are you going to spread it from person to person? How are you going to prevent it from becoming a doctrine and something which keeps people down instead of liberating people? How are the people in this room going to pass it on and guarantee that in 100 years or 200 years you don't have an Inquisition and anyone who's not keeping their book gets burned, you know? Or those who don't keep vow number 14, like I keep vow number 14, get expelled from the church. You know, it'll happen. You know, this is the honeymoon. Okay? You know, the forces of dogma will come and start to assert themselves. Okay? How do you prevent that? How do you keep things pure? We've been talking about that every step of the way, and you have to talk about it. Now, how are you going to keep Buddhism alive and flourishing in this country? So I want to address one thing. I'm going to just read it straight from a piece of paper, which I never do. But I think it's so important that I sat down and wrote it and thought about it for a few weeks, actually. Okay? So I'm kind of nervous because I've never done this before. Okay. It says, Tantra in America. Okay. How are you going to pass Tantra in America? How are you going to keep it pure? During this series of talks, we have been discussing the future of Buddhism in America and other Western countries. Its transmission from Asia, and the focus we'd like to see it take in our own countries. Since we are approaching the conclusion of the final review of the Buddhist Master Study Program, you're going to be Buddhist masters, okay? Which will be complete in 18 courses, And because the three-year retreat is soon to begin, and finally because our students as a group have reached what I think is a critical point in these matters, people are always coming up to me and asking me if you're going to teach Tantra or not. And I haven't. Okay? And you've never heard me teach Tantra in these classes. Question is, what's going to happen? Okay. I would like to address the future of Tantra in America. First point is called, why practice Tantra? People have asked me if I practice Tantra. The answer is, of course. And I devote a good part of each day to trying to master a wide range of various tantric texts, arts, and practices. I properly consider it the primary focus of my practice and my life. In general, the word Tantra itself means secret, and normally it should be practiced and taught in a very private way. But because of my role as a public teacher, because so much of what I do is done in the public eye, I think it is necessary for me to discuss openly, in brief, the reason and methods for the practice of Tantra, especially as I hope to see it develop in the West. The spread of an improper practice of Tantra would be a serious blow to the growth of Buddhism in our countries. Equally so, the failure to properly teach and follow the extraordinary methods of Tantra would be to deny a real chance for ultimate happiness to thousands of Western people. We have committed ourselves as Buddhists to ending pain in the world as quickly as possible. To do so, we must ourselves become enlightened beings. This can be accomplished either by following the sutra or open teachings of Buddhism, or it can be done through the practice of secret or tantric Buddhism. The standard text for the sutra method explained that even after achieving the very high level of real bodhicitta or the wish for enlightenment, it took Lord Buddha himself over 200,000 lifetimes to reach his enlightenment more. Okay? After Lord Buddha achieved enlightenment, he taught that this process can be reduced to one lifetime through the proper practice of Tantra. So if we are serious as Buddhists about ending the suffering that others and we ourselves must endure daily, it is our sworn responsibility to practice Tantra, and Tantra in its highest and most powerful forms, as quickly as we are able. So, you know, everybody here says they're here because they want to reach enlightenment. And then supposed to be that you're doing it for other people because you want to save other people from suffering. And thousands of people are suffering at this moment who weren't suffering 5 minutes ago. Okay? So you've pretty much sworn, I think most of the people here, to the Bodhisattva vows, you've sworn to do whatever necessary to reach enlightenment as quickly as possible. Which means it's not a question of should we practice Tantra or is it okay to practice Tantra. You have sworn already that you'll do whatever is necessary as quickly as possible. So there's really no question. You have to, as soon as you are properly able. The forms of Tantra. What then are the highest forms of Tantra? Tantric practice in general divides into four classes. These are distinguished by going from a greater dependence on outer focus and ritual in the lower classes up to a general focus on inward practice in the higher. Within the highest of the four classes of Tantra, there are three broad steps of proper preparation, actual practice, and final goal. There's four classes of Tantra. They're basically different from each other because in the lower classes, you're more concentrating on rituals, recitation, things like that. And then in the higher classes of Tantra, that shifts into more of a mental or an inward-focused practice. Okay. Within the steps of actual practice, there are two important levels. The first, in which we undertake to develop a special view of our reality, which is called Kirim, and the second, in which we use this view to work on our subtle spiritual body, which is called Dzogchen. This dual process ends in transforming the mind and body into the state of an enlightened being, a state of total knowledge, purity, compassion, and physical perfection. Work with a subtle spiritual body is itself done in two different ways. These involve a rigorous discipline of practice and study, including intense work with the physical channels throughout the body. I want you to understand a little bit about working with the channels. Okay? I'm not allowed to talk about it publicly in detail, but I think I have to. I've been forced to. Okay? Here we go. I would like to clarify this work with the channels briefly here, since it can so easily be misunderstood. In their current condition, certain subtle channels within our bodies are badly choked. This situation is aggravated every time we have a negative thought, and especially when we have any kind of misperception about the nature of the world around us, about how things really work. You have certain subtle channels running to your body. Every time you get angry, every time you get jealous, every time you have wrong desire, they choke a little bit more. Okay? What happens when they choke? By the way, the worst thing is to not understand the thing about the pen. Except there's two worst things, but I can't tell you because that's tantra. Okay. But they have to do with how you view your lama and things like that. Okay. This continual choking of the channels is in fact what makes our bodies mortal. It is responsible for the aging process, and unless corrected, eventually leads to our physical death. Every time you have a negative thought, certain areas of your body are choked. Every time you misperceive reality, which you're doing every second, they get choked. This is what kills you. This is why you die. This is why people die. What if you didn't do that? You wouldn't die. Okay? You'd be a tantric deity. That's how you get to be a tantric deity. And you gotta choose one or the other. You don't have any other choice. Okay? Either you clean up your channel act and become a tantric deity in this lifetime, or it kills you. And then your mind enters another state and there's millions and millions. I always call it the Moscow Hotel. They wanted the biggest one in the world. They didn't care that it's ugly, everything's lousy, but they got the most rooms in the world, 5,000 rooms on the Kremlin. You know? And dying is like that. You don't know what room you're going to be in. Only one room is usable to reach enlightenment in one lifetime. Okay? Next. When we work to fix this condition, we are using our defective physical body, our vessels, and in fact, to eliminate themselves. Okay? So you're using your body to get rid of your body. Okay? To eliminate, to replace them with the indestructible, perfect form of a tantric deity. This is a painstaking and difficult process requiring an extensive background in Buddhist philosophy and long, hard hours of training. It is about as romantic as cleaning a badly clogged toilet or cutting open a woman's breast in an operation to remove cancer. I mean, somebody might say the doctor is interested in this lady's breast. He's trying to cut open and cut out this cancer. I mean, forget it. He doesn't have any thought like that. He's totally beyond that thought. He's working with this part of her body. But his mind is to save her life. And he's doing that by removing that part of her body. See, I mean, it's very interesting. You have to use it to get rid of it. Okay? And that's a very interesting process. And difficult. And hard. And it takes a lot of holiness. Okay? All right. For certain personality types, much of this work is best accomplished through the cooperation of a tantric partner. And in fact, we are required by our vows in the highest form of tantra to seek out and undertake this means in the appropriate circumstances. Then you get into appropriate practice of tantra. What are the appropriate circumstances for the practice of these higher forms of tantra? One must first of all complete the proper preparation. And to put it quite bluntly, this is the entire goal of the 18 courses of this institute. Okay? You're getting through the preparation when you finish the 6 years. I didn't want to tell you that in the third year, you would have quit. Okay. Aside from study, one must internally have developed a true wish to escape from the inevitable suffering of this life, a genuine wish to use the holy Buddhist Dharma to escape from a world which is either pain already or pain waiting to happen. The gradual decay of our bodies and our minds, the loss of everything we have ever worked for, and being torn in the end from everyone we have ever loved. That's what you have to look forward to. Your body will fall apart. Your mind will get more and more stupid as the years go on. You will lose everything you ever went to work for. You will lose everyone you ever loved. That's your choice. Okay? It's the reason to practice tantra. We must as well have come to see that this suffering will not end with death. Whatever brought us here once can and will bring us here again. There is not a single compelling proof that the mind does not continue on after the functions of your physical body have ended. There are thousands of states of conscious life, from insect to human, which are obvious to us. There are millions more that are not obvious to us. At the moment of death, there are literally millions of forms of consciousness we can be thrown into. Almost all of them are simple chaos and terror. We cannot practice tantra. We cannot reach total happiness in any state of mind other than the one we are currently in, and you must lose it. Okay? That's the prospect. Okay? You got this window of opportunity. The intelligence that you currently have in your mind and the attraction to holy things is extremely rare, and you must lose it when you die. Okay? You can't wait to do these things. You have to, as soon as you're ready, you have to do them. Okay? We must die, we must go on, it can happen any moment of our lives. We must practice Tantra, we must do so now. We must also be resolved to practice it in the most powerful ways within our capacity. We may not have time to follow lesser paths. Consider finally the fact that a Tantric disciple who succeeds in this practice becomes in one fell swoop a person who can simultaneously reach out to thousands of other suffering people and guide them away from pain. The minute you succeed at your Tantric practice, you are emanating on other planets, okay? Billions of other planets. So that's an added attraction, okay? Tantra is at present taught in many forms. There are false and very filthy practices, many of which are simply common copulation with a glorified name, that are being taught and spoken about without any authority whatsoever in various New Age schools and the like. You can see it in, what do you call it? The thing you get free on the street. Learning Annex, yeah. Learn Tantra, 3 simple lessons, $140. You know, bring light clothing or something, you know. There are also public forms of Tantric initiations and teachings where eminent masters such as His Holiness the Dalai Lama have conveyed the broad principles of Tantra to large groups of people. Why do they do that? It's secret. Why is His Holiness going to teach 10,000 people the Kala Chakra in Indiana, who he's never met, most of them? In order to plant a powerful seed in them for secret Tantric practices in the future, as well as to combat common misconceptions about Tantra. His Holiness has written books about Tantra, and Ken Rinpoche has released books about Tantra. One of their goals is to put a seed in people's minds. The other goal is to fight all the dirty information about Tantra. Okay? Lastly, there are truly secret empowerments and practices which are transmitted privately to proven disciples by the extraordinary beings known as Tantric Masters. Okay? So now we've got to get into who's a Tantric Master. The success of Tantric practice depends solely on the proper guidance of a qualified Tantric Master. These are beings who started out like you and me and who by their intense efforts have been able to reach a completely different level. They are literally on a higher evolutionary plane, as different as a human is from an ant. Okay? So compare a normal person like us and a Tantric Master, just about comparing the intelligence of an ant to the intelligence of a human. You've got to get used to that idea. Okay? That's about the difference between us and them. Okay? Making contact with these beings, learning from them and having them lead us to ultimate happiness is in fact very similar to an ant trying to relate to a human. Due to the fact that we ourselves are on a much more primitive plane of being, the process of reaching them is first of all very rare, and secondly an often difficult and trying experience. Okay, you've read stories about Milarepa, Marpa, those guys, okay? It's true. All right? It's very difficult to have a Tantric teacher and a Tantric relationship. Because you're like an ant and they're like a human. Okay? And trying to understand what they want you to do and trying to do the right thing and trying not to see them as something other than a Tantric is difficult. Okay? It's not easy. All right? Imagine a summer meadow covered with marigolds and green grass. At the edge is a great oak tree. Nestled in one of the boughs of the tree is a great honeycomb. There is a human lying out under the tree enjoying the day. He sees the honeycomb, and he sees an ant scurrying around the roots of the tree in the dirt. Out of great kindness and care for the single ant, he determines to lead it gently up the entire trunk of the tree to the sweet honey. So you got to get this vision of a guy, a human, sitting under an oak tree, and there's an ant crawling around in the roots. And he's going to try to get the ant to go up to the top of the tree because there's some honey there, and the ant has no idea what's going on. Okay. That's about where we are when you have a Tantric teacher, okay? They're trying to help you, and all you feel is he's taking a single blade of grass and begins to nudge the ant, pushing out his behind with the blade of grass. To the ant, this is a very disconcerting and frightening experience. But remember, we are talking about a special kind of ant. He has some instinct, he has a seed of faith in him that says, perhaps something bigger is going on here. Okay, I mean, the idea of a Tantric disciple is you have some kind of extraordinary good karma in your mind. I don't understand what's going on 100%. This guy is trying to get me somewhere. I don't completely understand it. But I trust. Okay? In Tantra, this is the most important part. So he swallows his fear as best he can and accepts the guidance with occasional lapses of panic where it all gets too high. Talk about the ant. In the end, he gorges himself in the nectar of immortality. We are just about this far away from the level of the Tantric Masters, and to meet them, to learn from them, and be guided by them to total happiness within a single lifetime is just as difficult. Like the ant, our position as a lower form of life prevents us from understanding the actions they do to help us, the pokes they give us on our posteriors. Due to our own set of past actions and thoughts, due to our own set of karmic imprints, coloring and actually creating our reality, the people in Mongolia got it. 1,000 people yelling back, "Hosan!" in emptiness. They haven't studied it for 70 years. They've been not allowed to talk about it. And man, they got it in 1 hour, you know, okay? We often sometimes see the Tantric teacher master, especially in the beginning, act in a way which we cannot understand or appreciate. This is a common phenomenon in Tantra. We should expect it and learn to move on up the tree despite it. A person may even appear to be a Tantric master to one disciple and seem to be a normal, ordinary person to another. For those of you who have studied emptiness, this is also to be expected. We see only what our own level of past good karma allows us to see, and in fact there is nothing, quote, out there except what your past deeds compel you to see. And there's a famous story, and this thing mentions it. A Sangha, Master Sangha, 350 AD, is practicing in a cave. 12 years he tries to see this tantric angel called Maitreya. 12 years meditating, praying, reciting mantras, waiting for this guy to show up. Nobody shows up. He gets fed up. He quits. He walks down out of the cave. He's on the road going to town. He comes to a crossing, and he sees a dead, half-dead dog. It's been run over by a wagon wheel, and its guts are hanging out, and they're rotting, and there's horrible things in it, like maggots and everything else. So, you know, he decides he's going to help this dog. He's going to take this dog to the doctor, vet, 350 AD. And like he gets down, he starts to stuff the guts back in the body, and then he sees all the maggots. He says, "Wait a minute. Now I can't kill the maggots to save the dog. You see? I can't kill these things. I have to save them too." So he tries to pick one up and he squashes it. He says, "Oh my God, I can't do that." So he says, "You know, what's the softest part of my body? I'll lick them off the dog. The dog's guts are hanging out, right?" And he so he closes his eyes. He says, "This is too gross to watch." And he sticks his tongue out. And he goes down and down and down. And then finally his head hits the ground. And he's like, "Where's the dog?" And then there's Maitreya standing there. And he's, so a Sangha, you think he'd be happy, right? He gets mad. He says, "I've been in that cave 12 years. And you show up like this, you know. What took you so long?" And then Maitreya says, "Look, I was in the cave sitting next to you. You didn't have the karma to see me. You used to clear your throat when you're reciting. Remember you used to spit over on the left? I used to be standing there. I had to jump out of the way. You know. And you didn't have compassion. You know, you're this big shot Buddhist teacher. And you didn't have compassion. And now you got it with the dog, you know. And you were willing to save the dog like that, and that's why you're seeing these things, you know." So he takes Maitreya on his shoulders and he runs around town. "I did it, you know. Guess what everybody else sees? This rotten guts hanging out, this dog, this crazy guy is running around town. Okay, who's right? Who's right?" "They're both right." "Okay. Okay, so the townspeople say this guy's crazy. Is he crazy?" "I'd like to be crazy like that." Okay. Potential abuse of Tantra. This explanation leads us to the question of the potential abuse of Tantra. If things are however you see them, then what's to prevent someone from simply deciding on their own, "I'm ready to practice Tantra," when they're not? There's no authentic lineage of Tantra descended from Lord Buddha which does not say that the disciple must be thoroughly trained long before being led into the mandala, or the secret world of the Tantric master. The Tantric teachings repeatedly stress that the disciple must be deeply knowledgeable in each step of the open teachings, which happen to be presented in full in our institute's courses. The tantric path is not easy. It requires a great knowledge of Buddhist philosophy, a willingness to work long and hard in retreats and other practices, and unshakable confidence in one's tantric master. It should never be undertaken otherwise, since a failure to practice properly, a loss of faith in Tantra itself, would set the disciple back many years. This itself would be a grave bad karma for their teacher also, who, quote, falls with a student like one yak tied to another as the first falls off the cliff. If you teach Tantra to someone who's not ready, or if you practice, if you agree to teach it to someone who's not ready, then when they go to hell, you go to hell with them. That's a rule. Okay? And they say it's like two yaks on a cliff and they're tied together and one gets pushed off the cliff, the other one goes automatically, okay? So it's not only wrong for the student to try to study, it's wrong for the teacher to teach it. Tantra, therefore, is like fire, with a great potential for good if properly used and a very destructive power if improperly used. Whether this improper use be due to the mistakes of insufficiently trained people with good intentions, the carelessness of people who should know better, or even outright abuse by deluded people. The possibility of such abuse, though, cannot prevent us from fulfilling the tantric tradition in its highest form, any more than the existence of arsonists implies that we should ban the use of fire. As with fire, abuses can and probably will occur. Our goal, then, must be to establish procedures which will make it unlikely, thus still making the full and proper benefits of Tantra available to those who can use it to attain ultimate good within their life. At this institute, therefore, we have created a formal policy to assure that students are properly trained before attempting tantric study and practice. Policy of the institute. Okay, we're getting to the end, don't worry. This is the most important thing you ever said. All right, you said that before today. Okay. It is therefore the policy of this institute that tantric teachings will only be granted to students who have successfully completed the entire 18 courses of its Buddhist master's program. These 18 courses are based directly on the five great books of ancient Buddhism, along with the teachings on the step of the path called Lamrim, which constitute the Buddhist master or Geshe course in Tibetan Buddhist monasteries. In Tibet, it was a custom for monks to complete their Geshe studies in order to qualify for admission to tantric college. And I think this is a wise requirement. In Tibet, it's even harder, I didn't tell you. You have to be a Lhamba Geshe. Two Geshes per year out of 10,000 at Tsera get a spot in Gyume Tantric College. Okay? So we're not that hard. Okay? The first 15 courses may be taken optionally by home study, including listening carefully to each tape fully, completing all homeworks, quizzes, meditation assignments, and final exam. But the final three review courses must be taken either from myself or from one of my directly appointed assistant teachers. In addition to this requirement, a potential student must be examined by myself to determine whether they have sufficiently developed the inner spiritual qualities. You can imagine some smart guy getting through all the courses and still being a schmuck. Okay? I mean, we got to have some kind of mechanism to handle these people. Okay. They must have developed inner spiritual qualities, renunciation, compassion, and faith in the teachings and their teacher before receiving these teachings. In some cases, I may require an additional period of study and practice, along with special tasks for serving other people. Finally, no tantric teachings will be granted to a student who has not actively maintained a book. I call it a six-time book, okay? A vow observation for a period of at least 3 years. Okay? So you have 3 years ahead of you. No problem. Authenticity of the lineage. I'm going to read the whole thing. I hope you don't miss, okay? Yeah, okay. Oh, sit down, Sergeant. It's all right. Authenticity of the lineage. This is wherein I try to prove that I'm qualified, okay? The tantric teachings have a firm foundation in the word of Lord Buddha, and almost a quarter of the canon of his teachings are dedicated to these methods. That is about 20,000 pages of the Kangya. So to say that Tantra is not authentic or Tantra is not the word of the Buddha is to deny about a quarter of the whole scriptures. It's about 100,000 pages to say that a quarter of them are not valid. Okay? Tantra is valid. Buddha taught it about a quarter of his life. Okay? The Tengyur, or collection of early Indian commentaries upon the Buddha's own teachings, contain over 1,000 texts on Tantra. And the Tibetan masters themselves have written over 50,000 commentaries on these. More than 1,000 of these commentaries have already been input on computer by our project. Okay? So Tantra is for real. The tradition as it has come down to us is then real and authentic. Although I am hesitant personally to state my qualifications for granting tantric initiations and teachings, I would like to list them here, only for the benefit of those who have asked me to. Many people have come to me and asked me to teach them tantra, okay? This is my answer, all right? He's teaching his mother tantra. For those who are seriously interested in the possibility of receiving them for myself, I encourage each student of the Institute to be very careful in the selection of their tantric teacher. And I tell you quite frankly that I may not be the proper teacher for your personal needs. It is crucial, though, that you do seek a teacher out, that you find them and learn from them as quickly as you can. My training in the theory of tantra in this life has been accomplished as follows. Over the last 20 years, I've received group tantric initiations from His Holiness the Dalai Lama, from the late Khyabje Ling Rinpoche, senior tutor of the Dalai Lama and holder of the throne of Jedzo Kapa. From Ken Rinpoche Geshe Losam Tarchin, former abbot of Sen Mei Tiben Monastery, and from the late Song Rinpoche. Who was the Tantric Master of Ganden Monastery? I've received extensive group teachings on Tantra over the last 20 years from Ken Rinpoche Geshe Losam Tarchin and more specialized teachings from Genli Chenli Topke, abbot of Gyume Tantric Monastery. I've also received brief tantric initiations instructions from the esteemed Pabong Rinpoche. It's all a long story, okay? Bottom line is, they are very much like the pen, okay? And you see them if you work hard enough, okay? You bring them to you, and you don't go find them, okay? In other words, you can't go to Dharamsala with $50 and ask for a tantric initiation, okay? Like, you have to bring them to you by practicing very, very hard. And you won't see them unless you practice hard. Okay? Then it says you don't have to be a tantric master. You don't have to practice tantra if you're part of the institute. You know, you don't have to be a Buddhist, as you may have noticed. Okay? And I'm not saying everybody in this place has to try to practice tantra. I'm just saying, unless you're crazy, you should, okay? And you have to try as hard as you can, and you have to try the most serious practices you can, okay? I skipped some pages, but anyway, you can read it. Next page says, while I'm on retreat in Arizona, we will continue to have classes here, and I encourage people who want to learn these things to finish their 18 courses. Gives you a chance to finish them, okay? And we'll be continuing to hold those courses during the time I'm gone, okay? So even if you only have one or two finished, you can catch up by the time I get out and start teaching these things. That's what I'm saying, okay? And your work is cut out for you. It's not my problem if you don't do it. I'll start a series of tantric teachings when I get out. It'll take 4 or 5 years cycle. If you're not ready when I get out, you're going to have to wait, okay? So your work's cut out for you, okay? And I don't think you can do all 18 in the last 2 months, but you can try. Okay. In the case of partial completion of a course, meaning more than two absences during that course, the entire course will have to be taken over again. I don't want a spotty lineage. Okay? You got to take the whole thing over again. Okay? There's lots of people here who took 3 or 4 courses, classes in each course, or 8 or 9. Forget it. Oh no, 8 or 9 is okay. But unless it was 8 or 9, you have to start over that course over again. Okay? There's lots of courses that are not interesting to some people. Logic, Lojong, you know, I don't know, philosophy. I'm sorry, you have to take the whole thing. Otherwise, you won't be ready. Okay? You will not get it. And lots of people don't get it. Okay? You have to go through the whole thing. There's a reason why Jeso Kapa designed it that way. So you have to go through all of them. Okay? I urge each of you now to begin the process of planning your study. Also, Dr. Taylor is sitting here in Washington, D.C. with this big computer that tells me who finished what homeworks and what classes. Okay? And we'll print it out for each person. So you don't have to wonder, did I finish number 6 or not? You didn't. All right? But we'll make a list for each person, and your work will be cut out for you. And then we'll design a schedule of classes in the homes of the assistant teachers during the time that I'm in retreat. Okay? So you'll have a chance to cycle through the whole thing while I'm gone. Again, you can take the first 15 by home study, but you have to take the last 3 from someone who was in the last 3. Okay? Meaning Brooke. No, just kidding. Also, I encourage you to take Bodhisattva vows and layman's vows, and we'll be having those ceremonies one more time before I go into retreat. It's very, very important to have pratimoksha vows, ordination or lifetime layman's vows, or at least to be observing the 10 precepts. It's also very important. You cannot take a tantric initiation without Bodhisattva vows. Okay? And then you are granted tantric vows. Each one is built on the other. People who say that the lower vows are unnecessary for tantric practice are crazy. Jeso Kapa said they are like what? Do you remember? Hailstorm that rips through Lhasa Valley and ruins all the crops in 10 minutes. Okay? To have that idea that you don't need the lower vows to take the higher vows is ignorant. Okay? To have the idea also that you shouldn't prioritize your vows is equally ignorant. Okay? If you are in a nangdom, which is what? If you're caught in a, what do they call it? It's like a catch-22, but there's a better word. Double bind. Anyway, you've got this vow that says do this, and you've got this vow that says do that. You must do what the higher vow says. Don't go around saying people that you see who seem to not be keeping their lower vows, that you don't know that they're not keeping a higher vow. They may be the only person in this room keeping their vows. Okay? Get it straight. You have to respect your higher vows, even at the expense of apparently not keeping your lower vows. Okay? Period. If you don't, you're crazy. All right? And you're corrupt. Watching one vow throughout the day, you can do very happily with the 6-time book and encourage you to do it. In fact, it's the only way to get into tantric paradise. All right? And I'll break my tantric vows. It's a requirement for all higher tantric initiations. You must keep that book, okay? You might as well start now, okay? If you get a chance in the next 3 years, take initiation from Ken Rinpoche. He is, I'm not being biased, I certainly would never be. He is the greatest living master of tantra and sutra in the world today, period. You guys don't know what you have. They would love to have him back at Sarah. There's nobody left like him at Sarah, okay? They think he's crazy to waste his time on us. You know, he is. He was in Tantric College as the assistant to the abbot in 1957, when I was 5 years old. You know what I mean? And this is a blessing, okay? So if you can, try to take it from Ken Rinpoche in the next 3 years. Must try to do. Okay. Last thing it says here, there's always many last things. The course in Tantra will be taught both in Arizona and in New York. The course in Arizona will be more intense. We'll go through textual study. We'll go through the various visualizations. Then we'll go through mandala construction, dharma construction. Then we'll go through fire offerings, how to do a proper tantric retreat. And if you survive all that, you'll study Dzogrim, which is working with the channels. Okay? And it will take some time. But the whole course will be just as, I think, organized as this one is. You see what I mean? And that's been lacking, I think, in the West. You see what I mean? You'll be able to go through, it's not like a weekend initiation, which are great, but it'll be a regular course of study and practice that you have to go through in a very organized way and rigorous for 4 or 5 years or something like that. Maybe more. We'll see. Last thing it says here, I don't know if you know, how many colleges in Sarah Monastery? What are they? Sarah J. and Sarah May. Okay? I mean, it's famous. The Sarah Mays are smarter. The Sarah J.'s are... No, just kidding. This is a big rivalry we have, okay? We're from Sarah May. So are you, by the way. But people don't know there was a third college at Sarah, Ngakpat Datsang. There was a tantric college at Sarah. It was totally wiped out to the last monk, okay? Not a single monk. And it's gone. And I'd like to revive it, okay? Out in Arizona or somewhere, okay? It was a part of study at Sarah. And it's a necessary part of your study, okay? There was a tantric college. It's gone. Okay, so I'd like to see that course of study revived properly. Okay? Okay. Last thing it says here. How many last things? I will continue to teach in New York after the 3-year retreat. I intend to do 2 long courses a year here. And during the 3 years in Arizona, due to Winston's efforts and other people's efforts, there will be, I think, looks like, housing for anyone that wants to come out and be in retreat for a week or a month or a year or whatever you want. We found a way to make very inexpensive places. And we'll have 2 courses a year there, even during the 3-year retreat, of about 3 weeks each. Okay? And I'll teach those. So I encourage you to come. It says here that I will accept important messages and questions like life questions by writing in retreat on a very limited basis, and they'll come through John Stewart, I think. John will be directing this institute in New York during my absence, if he still wants to. Winston McCullough with his wife Andrea and son Kieran will be moving to Arizona in the next 6 months and creating that center there. And Elliot Vanderpas will be directing the actual retreat as far as caretaking and things like that. And you're very welcome to come and participate at any level that you're able to. Okay? We've kind of overcome all the housing questions and property questions. Looks like. Okay? You have to pray a little bit for that. Okay. That's all I have to say tonight. Next week, next class, I'd like to talk more about Buddhism in the West, about the form that Buddhism takes. Okay? Like, do we really have to blow those horns? You know, or could we just play violins or something? You see what I mean? And we'll talk more about that next class. Okay? Thank you for that. We'll do a dedication. Okay? Are you ready, Punzala? One thing before that, I think you've all got a copy of Ken Rinpoche's Long Life Prayer. Ken Rinpoche's birthday is coming up, July 1st.
Today.
His legal birthday is today. So we'd like to recite his long life prayer. This long life prayer was written by the teacher of the Dalai Lama, Tujan Rinpoche, who was Ken Rinpoche's root guru. Okay? Okay, do you have a copy? There's a special tune to this, which they usually do wrong, so try to listen, okay? Try not to run over me like a tractor. Okay? Okay? All right, here you go.
Mechen chen leo nang tam kyang chi de Ma grun tung chung
Excuse me, Lord.